Okay, halacha from Gemara. Last few weeks, we've been talking about understanding and analyzing the Gemara on Shabbos at Kuf Chav Gimel, 123b and then 124a, I think that's what it was. But today, and last week we already started this while we were on our Zoom, and now we're going to look at it inside. I think this is a first in the 3 years we've had this shiur, that we're going to use a physical book. This is called the Mishnah Berurah. We'll talk about that in a second and where we are in context of our discussion. I gave Sarita the right page, and he'll do the right page, but I did not give the two big Mishnah Berurah users the right page. So Bacha and Dina, we're looking at Siman Shin Chet. I don't know if you know how to do the Hebrew numbers there. Most likely it's going to be right in the middle of the book. I believe you're also in a Chelek Gimel of the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah is typically broken up into six sections. You're probably too far ahead, Adina, if I had to guess. What letter does it say on top?
Chaf.
Yeah. It couldn't be me. I gave you the wrong thing. What does the spine say on the back, on the back of your book? What letter? Is it Gimel?
Yeah.
Yeah, so let me see.
Oh, no, I mean, it's this letter. The Siman is in the middle of the page. I'm not talking about the page number. I'm talking about the page that the Siman of the Shulchan Aruch. So, you there, Bacha? You got it?
I think so.
Shin Chet?
Siman Shin Chet.
There you go. Yeah, you're right. So we're going to be in Siman Shin Chet, which is in English 308. Hildy, you might have the number 308 somewhere on your page. Maybe at the top somewhere, I don't know. And we're going to be in Siv Gimel. Siv Gimel. Hildy, you have an interesting one because it's 308.
We're going to do number 3. And it's going to start down here. This is the translation of this, which is the Mishnah Berurah we're going to talk about. Okay.
We got it?
That's her face.
Where's the medical salad? No, it's in the middle. Here. It's in the middle of the
line. It's right
after.
See what I'm saying?
Here's
the right
here.
Oh, okay.
It was right afterwards. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Mishnah Berurah. What is the Mishnah Berurah? The Mishnah Berurah is a commentary. We actually learned some of it last week, briefly online. But you don't get the same sense of, you know, the Mishnah Berurah writing on pages. You know, you don't get the sense of tradition when you're reading it on a screen with digitized text. It's not something you can really appreciate. So here we have the book of the Mishnah Berurah. On the top of the page, this is what we call the Shulchan Aruch. If I were to say, hey, get me a Shulchan Aruch, you would not bring me this book. This book happens to have the Shulchan Aruch on it because the Mishnah Berurah is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is a big book, and it has other super commentaries, which are much more thorough and comprehensive than the Mishnah Berurah, although the Mishnah Berurah, for its own right, does a really good job of compiling a lot of those opinions within his commentary. But this is really, when you look at a book like this, this is an older version of it. And when I say old, I mean like 50 years. I'm not saying like old. It's not like, you know, the Mishnah Berurah was published in 1933, or around then. That's when the Chofetz Chaim died, so some of it, I think, was published after he died, actually. So I don't know exactly when, how it was published. But the point is that that this book, despite including the Shulchan Aruch, actually looks a little different than the Shulchan Aruch itself. Let me just mute the passes here. Love having you on. If you want to say something, feel free. We just muted each other. Okay. So the point is that this is what you have here. You have the top. You have the Shulchan Aruch. That's written by Rabbi Yosef Karo in the 16th century. And then underneath that, you'll have a few different commentaries. You see that the page is broken up into different sections. I don't know what word to use, but the most informative and the one that we're going to focus on, when most people focus on, is the literal Mishnah Berurah. You can see here, you have five sections of commentary underneath the Shulchan Aruch, right? The top of the Shulchan Aruch. It doesn't even have a title. That everyone knows that's the Shulchan Aruch. Underneath you have, on the side, you have something called the Sha'arei Tshuva, And the Shari Tshuva is by Chaim Mordechai Margolius, which is usually somewhat smaller and gives you sort of the sources. The Be'er Heitev sometimes explains just in terms of what the words mean and what the context of the words is. The Be'er Heitev that was written by Rav Yehuda Ashkenazi. I don't remember, the name sounds very familiar, but I don't remember who he was. No, I don't know. I feel like he's related to Rav Yehuda Ashkenazi, but not for sure. And then you have on the middle, sort of, I guess, the middle section of the commentaries is what we have, the Bir Halacha and the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah is the main commentary. As you can see, it takes up most of the page. But also the Bir Halacha is written by the Mishnah Berurah. Okay, so the Chafetz Chaim wrote both of these commentaries. One of the Bir Halacha goes into like more depth into the background of how do we get to these conclusions, whereas the Mishnah Berurah is going through, you know, the different conclusions of the different halachic decisions throughout history. So he'll bring up a lot of, you know, more modern poskim and other commentaries and even recent halachic works. Very, very rarely does he quote a contemporary. I heard this once from the Rabbi Yehoshua Hartman, who's most well known for his commentary on the Maharal. Those books, you probably don't even know what I'm talking about. The Maharal is, you know, the Maharal of Prague, you know, the Golem story. Unfortunately, the one thing people know about him is not true about him, but okay, fine. The Maharal is an unbelievable thinker of the 17th century. So those blue books, you see they're like maroon books right next to my Muslim. Maroon books and then blue books to the left of that. So that's the Maharal. Those blue books is actually only like one or two of those red books. But Rabbi Yehoshua Hartman, who's a rabbi in England, he's an unbelievable compiler of the Maharal's thoughts. And if you look at one of those books, so the Maharal is like three lines on the top, and then the rest of it is all footnotes. And he just goes through, and he talks about this, the same idea over here, and talks the same idea over there. Either way, I was privileged to hear him speak a couple of times in YU. And he claims that the Mishnah Berurah only ever quotes a contemporary twice. A contemporary meaning someone who was alive during the Mishnah Berurah's lifetime. Almost always Mishnah Berurah is talking about someone who's most recently passed. More recent postgame. And one of them I remember he said was the Meshech Chachma, Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk, also known as the Or Sameach. And the other one, it's not coming to me right now. I'm just thinking of another aspect of the Meshech Chachma. Either way. I can't remember. I want to say it was someone from Brisk, but I don't know. So this is the Mishnah Berurah's commentary. So he compiles a lot of the more recent, and the reason why the Mishnah Berurah became so popular is because he does a wonderful job not only representing the Ashkenazic Pesach, which always needs more clarification because we were all over the world, but also because he has a really good feel for how to apply things to modern living. Now, when we say modern living, obviously we don't mean this 2023, modern living in Rodin of 1930. So there are a lot of differences, and you always have to be on the lookout for, you know, what the Mishnah Berurah understands to be, you know, application of modern living, what's not. But that's why I said it's very interesting that right now in the morning, you can ask David about this, Dina, we're talking about where you can say Shema outside of a shul. Let's say you're in a home, you'll say you're in a field. Can you say Shema in a bathroom? Can you say Shema in a bathhouse? And never does the Mishnah Berurah really go through what about modern plumbing, because he probably didn't have modern plumbing even in 1933 in Rodin. He lived somewhat of a poor lifestyle. Either way, so he's oftentimes very modern in terms of his psak, and it's become. I would say 90% of modern psak and application is based on the Mishnah Berurah. You know, if you want to know how we passing in the halachas, you look at the Mishnah Berurah. That's usually how it goes. So here also we're going to do that. There's another book. But some of these things, I don't know, there's Hashkacha Pratis, if you want to call it, or a certain providence that certain books become more popular. I don't know how the Mishnah Berurah became so popular. I remember Herschel Schachter, my Rebbe, told me that when he was married, he had never even learned any Mishnah Berurah. I think he was married in, you know, the 60s or something, I don't know. But the point is that until he got married, Mishnah Berurah wasn't really the go-to sefer. It was the Chaye Adam, was the sefer people looked at for modern Pesach. Then the Mishnah Berurah became more popular, and now everybody looks at the Mishnah Berurah. Like no one even, and I think he quotes Bechai Adam a lot, but those were the two sort of Ashkenazi go-to poskim. And for better or for worse, the Mishnah Berurah has become the go-to, despite the fact that I believe it was Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe said that whenever he had a question about how to paskin between the Mishnah Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan, right, Rav Chil Michal Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan was also a commentary on, it's also a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. He died a little bit before, I want to say even before the 1900s, but not by much. So Rav Moshe would always say he would paskin with the Aruch HaShulchan, because the Aruch HaShulchan was the rabbi of a shul and a community, whereas the Mishnah Berurah was the rav of a yeshiva. It's a lot easier to give chumras when you're the Rosh Yeshiva of a bunch of bachurim, single guys who, you know, it doesn't affect anybody else's life. Now that's just in terms of his sensitivity day to day. He obviously has sensitivity to people in their lives and otherwise, but you can understand where the Moshe was coming from when he was dealing with people with homes and children and wives, whereas the Mishnah Berurah was day to day dealing with bachurim. Either way, I read that once. You can't always believe everything you read, but it's an interesting idea to think about. This is Mishnah Berurah. We are picking up in the middle of the Shulchan Aruch, okay? The reason why we're picking up in the middle of Shulchan Aruch is because this siman, Shit and Ches, deals with all topics Muktzah. Everything about Muktzah is in 308. Now, we are talking about one subset, potentially, of Muktzah, right? That's what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. Is what we're about to talk about, what we've been talking about, a Muktzah thing, or is it an independent thing? Now, regardless of whether we contextualize it or categorize it as a Muktzah thing or a non-Muktzah thing, either way, it's going to be in the laws of Muktzah because of its resemblance to everything about Muktzah, not touching things, not moving things, etc. So this is Shin Ches. You'll see that at the top of the page, Hilchos Shabbos Siman Shin Ches. And we are going to do Se'if Gimel. Se'if Gimel, I believe even the Batsha and Adina have the modern printing versions of the Mishnah Berurah, but I believe they kept the pagination pretty consistent, even in the modern printings. So tell me if I'm wrong, is this the third line down? It's the third line for you also, okay? Sarita, you with me? The third line down? The Gimel. So you'll notice some of these words, okay? Kli shemalachto le'iser. Ignore all the little letters in between, right? That's a skill you have to pick up when you're learning these things. Just ignore the little letters, okay? Kli shemalachto le'iser, a vessel which its primary use is for prohibition, i.e. a hammer, right? That's been our example for a kli shemalachto le'iser. So then mutter le'taltalo, you are allowed to take it. Let's skip the parentheses for now. That's the Ramah adding a wrench into the equation. I don't mean a literal wrench. I mean just a proverbial wrench, because he's making it more complicated. What if you use it in Banish Meshos? We're not going to talk about that right now. But if you skip past the parentheses and you go to after the Yud Beis, if you have a Yud Bet there. So Bein L'Tzorech Gufo, right, regardless of whether you need it, the thing itself, Kigon. Kigon means, for example, right, like a Kornas Shel Zahavim, like a hammer of a goldsmith, O Nefachim, or, Hilde, do you have a translation there? Number three on the top. You have on the top of the page, number three. Vessels. Good. Yeah, keep going. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's in the parentheses. After parentheses, it says, for its own sake, like a hammer. Okay, yeah, after that, keep going.
Either if one wishes to use the utensil.
For, okay. The utensil, keep going.
It is necessary for the ruling to be given explicitly, because one might otherwise think that since it is...
Oh, no, that's something else. I'm just trying to figure out the word nefachim. How do they translate the word nefachim?
Either if one goldsmith and a blacksmith?
Okay. For jewelry. Okay, blacksmith is more intense. Either way, they both have hammers. That's the point for us. I just didn't know. I didn't want to translate it without the literal translation. So, to hit nuts, to open them up. Or kordam lachtoch bo devela, or some kind of, it's like a big knife. What's it called? Hatchet, yeah. Is that what you have there? Okay, yeah, a hatchet. That's good. You found that one too. So a hatchet to cut through pressed figs, cakes. Bo devela, right? It's abnormal. That's the whole point. That's the whole point. The whole point is you don't have a knife. Can I use my hatchet from the slaughterhouse, you know? Bein letzarach makomo, or you need the space. What does that mean? Dahainu is, which is, shetzarich lihishtamesh b'makom shakli munach sham. You need to use the place that the utensil is placed within. All right, it's hard to translate it into English. And then says the Shulchan Aruch, umutar lo litol misham. You can take it from there. Ulahanicho be'ez makom sheyirteh. You can take it from that place and put it wherever you want. Aval, however, this is all from the Gemara, right? This is halacha from Gemara. Aval mechama letzel, but from the sun, the chama, very hot, to the tzel, which is the shadows. Dahainu she'enu tzarech letzal tzelo, ela mivnei she'yarei she'yishaver o yiganev sham. Meaning, right, dahainu, meaning, which is that it's not required for itself to take it. Rather, you are afraid it's going to break or it's going to be stolen there. So then, asur. So then, it's forbidden. It's prohibited to take that item. The Rama adds there that anything which is asur is only asur to move, not to touch. Fine. That's the Shulchan Aruch. I believe we've even quoted that before. Now, if you go back to the beginning of Gimel, you'll see that after the word kli, there's a yud. You see that yud? For Hildi, it's a number 10. You'll see there's a number 10 there. So you go to the bottom in the Mishnah Berurah. You notice there are all these different kinds of letters, right? So when you're first starting out trying to figure out how things are referencing different things, you have to really pick up on the different kinds of letters. Sometimes, especially in new Gemaras, where they have all these things in the margins and everything. You have to know not only the kind of letter, sometimes it's a Rashi script letter, sometimes it's a block letter, sometimes it's a cursive letter. So there are all these different types of letters. Then you have to look at whether it's a parenthesis or a bracket. Then you have to look at if there are two parentheses on both ends or there's only one parenthesis on one end. So here, we are looking at for a yud. This yud is a block letter yud, I believe. I believe it's a block letter yud, even though my my print looks a little, iffy. But it's a block letter yud with two parentheses on each side. So, which of these commentaries has a block letters with two parentheses on either side? Happens to be, in this case, they all have parentheses on both sides. So if you look, the Mishnah Berurah is what we're looking for. I don't know if you can see it. In my Mishnah Berurah, it is the second to last skinny line of the Mishnah Berurah. You see there's the skinny section of the Mishnah Berurah, and then there's the section that spans the width of the page. So this is two lines before it opens up into the width of the page. There's a yud there, and the words are shemelach tol le'isur. Okay, you see that? Sarita, you with me? Yeah, good, exactly. It's really in the middle, but okay. Shemelach tol le'isur. This is a commentary. What does it mean that its use is prohibited? Right? What does it mean for a hammer to be prohibited in its use? Okay. Klomar says the Mishnah Berurah, Shem miyuchedet ledavar sha'asur la'asos b'shabbos. It is miyuchad. What does miyuchedet mean?
Special.
It's unique or designated. Right? Now, the word miyuchad is connected to the word echad, which probably means closer to exclusively for, but I don't want to translate it like that because we're using it for a different thing. Right, that wouldn't be exclusive if you're using it for something else. But the point is that it is designated for a specific use. It's specified for whatever you want to say. It's designated for something which you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. Va'afilu. Now that Yud Aleph, you might say, well, why is there another reference? Why is there another letter there? That goes to the bottom, which is a super, super commentary, right? The Mishnah Berurah is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, and the Sha'ar Tzion is a super commentary on the Mishnah Berurah. And if you were to look at the Sha'ar Tzion, oftentimes will actually just quote the source of something. In this case, he's not. He is, but he's not. He's giving a little more context to it. This is Yud Aleph. Kain Muchach Be. I don't know what those letters are. Dalad Hei Chet. Derech HaChaim. Okay, it's a different paper. Mimashikatsov Le'inan Kedera Al Ayin Sham Ba'ayim Be'er Alecha. Okay, he's just telling you, if you want to know where, who else says the same type of thing the Mishnah Berurah is about to say, you can go look at those farms. Okay? We don't have those farms. We do have the Be'er Alecha. It's right above, right? It's right to the side, to the left. But we're not going to look at that right now. Okay? So this is Va'afilu, right? The next words in the Mishnah Berurah, back in the Mishnah Berurah. Va'afilu imrak rov melachto l'isr hu gamkein bichlal zeh. Now we're going to get some interesting discussion here. Even if afilu rak rov melachto l'isr. Majority. If 51% of the time what you're using this thing for is a prohibited purpose, so that's also considered a klishim melachto l'isr. Right? So you and I look at a hammer and we say, what is a hammer used for? 99.9% of the time, it's for building. Right? That's like virtually always used. It's entirely used for something you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. But then we have other things. Let's say a pot. Let me ask you, Hildy, you have a pot at home? You have a pot? I feel like I'm starting like Abbott and Costello. You got a pot at home? Right? Yeah, I got a pot. All right? So you have a pot at home. If you were to determine what percentage of the time are you using that pot for cooking, and what percentage of the time are you using it for storage? What would you say? 99% cooking, because you transfer it into something else. Okay, so for Hildy, it's not even a question. A pot would clearly be a klishim melachto l'isr. Some others would say, well, I cook in, let's say, Pyrex.
Yeah.
Would be a better example, maybe. You can cook in Pyrex, even though we've broken plenty of Pyrex cooking in them. But okay, fine. You can cook in Pyrex. And you use it, bake, whatever, and you can use it as, and you typically use it for storage in the refrigerator. So then what's the percentage of use of that Pyrex container? Is it mostly baking or mostly storage? Is there ever a time? Well, because it could be a klishim melachto l'isr. According to the Mishnah Berurah, we're now trying to determine what is the definition of something that I can't move for its own protection. Because remember, if it's something which is klishim melachto l'heter, right, like a napkin holder, you can move that for almost any purpose, depending on how we explained it last week. Either anything, right, as we said, who was it last week that we quoted? I think it was the Shevet HaLevi that said that anything is a tzoreh. Right, I want to play with something, that's a tzorach too. Right, so you could use it for anything, it's klishim melachto l'isr. But once you say it's a klishim melachto l'isr, once it's designated for a prohibited purpose, so then you're only allowed to use it if you're going to use the thing itself for the sake of storing stuff in it, or if you're going to move it for the place that it's in. But you can't just move it around willy-nilly, you can't just play with it, you can't even move it to protect it. You're worried that your cat's going to break it if it's on the floor or something. I don't know. Whatever it is, you cannot protect the item for the sake of protection. So now we have to figure out, well, then how do we look at this dish? This dish is either a klishim melachto l'isr or it's a klishim melachto l'heter. It's either designated for prohibited use or it's designated for permitted use.
But there's nothing prohibited with keeping it for storage.
No, but we have to decide what is its main use.
Main use.
The Mishnah Berurah says, how do we define it? 51%. Whatever it's used most of the time to use for, whatever it's used most of the time for, so that's going to be its designation. So if it's a pot, we've now determined you cannot touch a pot unless you're using the pot for a good purpose, or you need the spot where the pot is. Because its most use, most of its use is for the sake of cooking, which is prohibited. So then you can use it. That's a Torah. Yeah, yeah. If you need the pot for something, you can absolutely use the pot. Right now we're talking about, you know, your kid says, hey, I need, you know, I want to play with a pot. Can I touch the pot or is it mukta? So, well, you can't. Playing is not a real Torah. It's not a real need, so it'll be mukta. Or let's say the pot is outside. I don't know why the pot would be outside, but the point is that it's some dangerous place. You want to move it to protect it. You don't want anyone to grab it. You don't want anyone to break it. You don't want anyone to get it dirty. So can I move it to protect it? So now that we've determined that a pot is mostly used for cooking, you're not allowed to move that pot to protect it. You can move it for other things. If it's in the way, you're trying to get to something else, so that's Torah Makomo. You're trying to use the space. Or if you need something to store it, you need something to store stuff in, you can use it for that too. Here we're talking about for protection, because again, that's the only difference between Kli Shemachtel Is or Kli Shemachtel Has. Says Mishabruah, 51%. So now the Pyrex dish. I see, oh, Nevach, we had a picnic yesterday outside, now we left the Pyrex dish on the balcony, or on whatever, the porch, you know, by our table in the sukkah. That's a good example. It's Shabbos Chol Hamoed Sukkah. And you left the Pyrex on the table outside in the sukkah. Oh, you never. Now, well, if you need the table, so then you can obviously move it. If you need the space, that's for sure. Let's say you don't need the table. Let's say you just left the Pyrex out, and you're worried that some animal is going to come and take your Pyrex. You're going to break your Pyrex. It's going to, whatever. Or the kids, or the wind, or the rain. You're worried about the Pyrex. Are you allowed to move your Pyrex bowl inside? Now we have to figure out, well, what is the majority use, according to Mishabura, what is the majority use of that Pyrex bowl? Is it majority use for cooking and baking, which would be a Kli Shemalachto Le'Isser, it's prohibited act, or is majority use for storage? That's not an easy calculation. If I were trying to determine that, I would say majority is used for storage. Because whenever I cook in it, I always use it to store it also. So that's always 50-50. But then there are other times where I don't cook in it, but I still use it for storage. You get what I'm saying? So anytime I'm cooking with it, it's always used for storage. But then there are also other times where I'm using it for storage when I never cooked in it. So that would mean that more than 50% of the time I'm using the Pyrex for storage. That would be my calculation. Everybody else has their own calculation. Maybe sometimes you cook in it and then you empty it out into a serving dish or something, and that changes the calculus. For us, either because we're lazy or because we like the way the Pyrex looks, so we serve it in that dish, right? We don't take things out of it. So that's our question. Mishnah Berurah says that the definition of Kli Shemalachto Le'Isser is Rov Tashmisha, is the majority use of its the majority purpose of its use. Okay, so if you still have your hand on the plate, we're in the last skinny line of the Mishnah Berurah. Shem Yuchedes LeDavar She'Asur La'Asos B'Shabbos Va'Afilu Imrak Rov Malachto Le'Isser. Who gam came bichlal zeh? Oh no, did my computer just go out? Oh, sorry, the cat is. I did not know I was low on battery. Either way, so let's keep reading. That's the beginning of this halacha. So that's he started off with a big helpful chiddush for us. Okay. Weird. Hi, Reina, and Jeff. I'm trying to kick myself off here. Okay. Oh, okay. It did it for me. Now I just have to unmute myself. Okay. Hi, Cassius. Sorry about that. My computer died. Okay, so now we're on to Yud Aleph. So if you look, well, I don't want to make you look. Actually, no, we're not going to do Yud Aleph. That's in the Ramah. Let's go to Yud Beis. Yud Beis is the end of the second wide line. You see it? Block letters, Yud Beis. Bein l'tarach gufo. Says the Mishnah Berurah, Umairi she'ein lo kli heter l'tashmir zeh. This is something we've never talked about before. You've got two items. You have a soup bowl and you have a pot that you're cooking. Now, I would prefer to use that pot. I like the sturdiness of it. I can store it better. But the pot is a klishim alach d'leser. And technically, I should only be using that if it's necessary to use it. What does it mean, necessary to use it? I'm going to be using it just like the hammer. But wait a second, says the Mishnah Berurah. Part of Soreth, part of necessity is that you need to use this and you can't use anything else. Meaning I have a nutcracker. I don't know what a nutcracker is, but I've heard the word. I don't have one, no. What is it?
It's like a pliers.
Okay, pliers. Okay, I feel like it would be okay on Shabbos. Because there's not a problem to cut crack nuts on Shabbos.
Right, it's
so the point is, you remember using it on Shabbos? Okay. Not a proof, but good. Not a proof, that's good. Right, you're only using it for that. You don't use it for a broken purpose. Good. So if you've got a hammer, and you say, oh, look at that hammer. You know, and everyone's getting, what's the type of nut that you have to crack open? A walnut?
Yeah.
Okay, nowadays no one has those. You just buy them already. I know you can. Old school Jewish mothers would probably get the originals. I know. New generations just buy them already undone in a bag. Our hands are more frail than the previous generation. The point is that let's say we've got a bunch of walnuts and everybody's eating. So, but we only got two nutcrackers. So some people are going to have to use something else. So, I've got, just use a hammer. So now, wait a second. Can we use a hammer when the nutcracker is available? Is that considered a tzorech? Is that a tzorech? What is the necessity there? It says the Mishnah Berurah, Umairi, and it's discussing a situation where, Umairi, I think is an Aramaic word. Umairi, the situation is, She'ein lo kli heter l'tashmir zeh, that there is no other vessel, utensil, for this purpose. You can step on it, I guess that's also possible. What are these letters? Anyone know? Do you have letters after that? Do you have an acronym right there?
No.
Oh, you have words. V'im lav hachi? Okay. I have four letters. Dalet, Aleph, Lamed, Hey. I happen to know what they mean. I was wondering if you did. Good. V'im lav hachi. If that was not the case, Ein lo lihishtamish beklize. There is not to him the ability to use this utensil, right? Because if you don't have a Torah, you can't use it.
Okay.
If it's a klishim l'achtalister. That goes for the hammer, that goes for the pot, right? That goes for anything which is typically usher which is typically designated for something which is usher on Shabbos. Okay, moving on. U'lahanich be'ezamachim, you can put it wherever you want. Why? Says the Mishvur de Kevan, which is once. Kevan is used in different ways, but the Kevan Shehu Biyado, once it's in your hands, Shenatla L'Tzarach Gufa, it's taken, you took it, Shenatal Ota, that's probably what it means there, Shenatla with a ma'pik, as we say, a dat and hey, Shenatla L'Tzarach Gufa, you've taken it for its sake, O Mekoma, or for its place, Rashai L'Taltala Yoster, you can continue moving it. Once it's in your hands, you don't have to put it down, it's not a hot potato, right? You can move it wherever you want. The Kasiv Ha? Very good.
The
Gashma Ha Magen Avraham. Good, I'm glad you're following along. But for me, that is an acronym. Hey Mem Aleph, right, Sarita? You have an acronym there? Yeah, no, that print is... The more modern Mishnah Berurahs do a good job of that. The Kasiv Ha Magen Avraham, with Avram Gombiner, who was the 1700s. Dehu Hadin, you have that one? Dehu Hadin? Yeah. Dehu Hadin, Im Shachach v'Naflo B'Yada. Let's say you absent-mindedly picked up the hammer. Oh no, what did I just do? It's in your hand, you're fine. Because it's a kli. If it was muktzeh, that would be different. If you go out on the street and you picked up a rock by accident, so then you got to drop it. Just like, for instance, you have money in your pocket, you got to drop it. It's muktzeh. Right? You can't continue carrying muktzeh. This is probably not muktzeh. Depends how you categorize it. That was last week, right? So that's what we're talking about here. It's a kli. Because it's a kli, once it's in your hand, you can move it. You can continue carrying it more. Even though the picking it up was prohibited. You should not have picked it up. But now you picked it up, so now it's still good to go. And look at the achronim. I love when the Mishnah Berurah uses the word achronim. Because he's an achron. But he's referring to the people that came before him. Now, 70, 90 years later, we look at the Mishnah Berurah as an achron too. But he's referring to the people that came most recently. Ayin b'achronim means, look at the poskim of the previous generation, the Chatam Sofer, Rabbi Kiva Eger, Rabbi Nodi Behuda, different people like that. Shehechri'u. Hechri'ah, anyone know? Machri'ah is to... Machriya is more like to conclude based on weighing the sources. Trying to figure out what do we say in Rabbi Yishmael Omer at the end? Ashiyagol Kasev Ashlishu V'yachriha B'nehem. Right. So we say at the end of then the Rabbi Yishmael is the sort of the different logical tools, hermeneutical principles that we use to delineate how to what psukim mean, whatever. And at the end it says, what if you have two psukim that are contradictory? So it says you look for the third that's going to outweigh or break the tie. I don't know if there's an English word for that. I'm sure there is. To conclude based on the numbers, right? Machria is like you weighing down or you're concluding on one side of the argument, right? Shehechriu, that they concluded the high hetera, this allowance, lo shayech ella, it's only, right? Whenever you have a low ella, it really means only. It is not relevant except for b'kli shemalachto le'ister. Only when it comes to a utensil whose purpose is prohibited. V'lo b'mukta mach maskufo. Then not because of mukta. This is what I was just saying. The only allowance for something which is in hand to continue moving it is because it's a kli. If it would be considered something which is muktzah, like what? Muktzah machmas gufo. That was our previous theme. Muktzah machmas gufo. Something which is inherently muktzah, like a rock or a stick or money, right? Kagon, ma'ot va'avanim uchiyot behen. Ma'ot means money. Avanim means stones or anything else like that. So that would not be, v'loba muktzah machmas gufo. You could not continue moving those. Like I just said, if you find money in your pocket, it very often happens all the time, unfortunately, you find money in your pocket, or sometimes, let's say, I wear my Shabbos suits to a wedding. And when I'm at the wedding, so because it's the weekday, I'll put a pen in my pocket. And then lo and behold, forgetful me, Shabbos comes along, I'm sitting there, Friday night or walking back home Friday night, and, oh my gosh, there's a pen in my pocket. And then I have to take it, hopefully, in some kind of shinoi manner, and then I just drop it wherever I am. You got to drop it, right? So the point is that's because it's muktzeh machmas gufo. Muktzeh machmas gufo, you have that kind of restriction. But a kli shemalach le'iser, something which is like a hammer, it's not muktzeh. This, by the way, is not muktzeh machmas gufo. That would be muktzeh machmas iser, which is a different category we haven't gotten to. But we'll catch that later. But that's treated like muktzah. Muktzah is something you have to get rid of as quickly as possible. You can't move it at all. Kli is different. And that's why I told you the story about my Rebbe who picked up the phone. I didn't tell you about this? I was once at a Rebbe's house on Shabbos day. And I think it was a Shabbaton or something in Israel. He lives in Neve Daniel, beautiful place. And his kid had picked up a phone and walked it across half the living room and just dropped it right there in the middle of the living room. So the Rav said, well, I need that space. right? It's Tzarech Makomo. The question I always had was, is that a kli? I don't think a phone is a kli. You don't do anything mechanical with it. It's not a kli. That's more of a kli shemala. That's really muktzah machmas iser, or muktzah machmas chisaron kis. It wasn't an iPhone, but I don't know how expensive it was. Maybe it was a valuable item. So I thought that it could be that he did the inappropriate thing, but he picked it up and announced, he said to everybody, I need this space, and once I'm holding it, I can put it wherever I want. I don't know, because this Mishavura, because I don't know if a phone is categorized as a kli. It can only be moved wherever you want if it's a kli. Now, that doesn't mean you have to leave the phone there. You could kick it somewhere. That's the, you know, that's the a tiltul min hatzad is shinoi, but you can't pick it up with your hands. So that's where I don't know if he was right. But if you continue reading, it says here, ubebir hagrala el simin reish samach vav simin yin beis. Those you don't have. You don't have. That's spelled out simin yud beis? Really? If yud beis? Okay, very good. Simin Reish Tamach Vav Seif Yud Beis Cholik Al Magen Avram disagrees with the Magen Avram. Us, what's the next word? Usvirelei. Oh gosh, you guys have everything. Yeah, I have Tamach Lamed here. Usvirelei, and he's of the opinion it is his he Svirelei as a svara, as far as like a logical argument. His logic is Svirelei, lei is Aramaic, but it means his logic. Delo he tiru ella. The only time that they are allowed to move it around once you pick it up. Ella kashe hischil lataltil birshus. What does birshus mean?
With permission.
With permission, meaning you did it allowed. Not if you did it by accident. If you picked up a hammer because you needed it for something, then you can move it somewhere. But if you picked it up haphazardly, absentmindedly, so says the Gra, what gives you the right to move it wherever you want? Right? Default state is that it's usher. This connects back, I'm not going to confuse you, but it does connect back to something we said 2 weeks ago, that the Gro believes that this whole concept of klisha malach del iser, klisha malach leter, is an independent concept. Even Rabbi Shimon would hold like, and therefore its default is you can't move it at all, and only for the sake of verse. So it fits nicely with that concept, that the Gro believes you can only move it around wherever you want once you've picked it up under the pretense of a real Torah. But if there is no Torah, so then default it's usher. You can't move it. It's like muktzah. It's not like muktzah. You have to drop it wherever it is. Whenever you figure it out, oh my gosh, I just picked up a hammer. Right? I can't believe it. Just make sure your foot's not in the way. Or anything, yeah. Or your hardwood floors or whatever. V'chein mashman baran resh beit ta'ayin shan. V'ayin l'kaman simin shen lamad aleph. Sif hei v'mishna b'ruv l'inin izmal mila. Right, we talked about that before, the bris mila knife. The bris mila knife is a little bit different. Why is the bris mila knife different? Is that not a kli?
But you can use it on Shabbos.
You can use it on Shabbos, true. But is it not a kli?
It is.
It is a kli. So why would that be different? Why does he tell us to look over there? What's different about a bris mila knife? It's special. It's special. That's not just a kli anymore. That's something which is designated and unique for a specific reason. You can't touch that thing. That stays in a special box on the top shelf so the kids don't get to it. So nobody uses it for their chicken. Right? That's the special bris mila knife. I just throw that in there. Okay. The point is that an ismal or izemel is it's a completely different thing. Okay. Isa b'simin shin yud aleph sif ches the tiltul muktzah begufah afil l'tarach dvar hamuktzah mutter dezelo nikra tiltul klal. So this gets a little more complicated. We'll probably do this later on about how to understand muktzah for something which is necessary. V'izayim munach etzadavra muktzah ala aretz mutter zachfav barag lav kadesh le'avul hafzit. You can push it away with your feet, as I said before. You can kick it away so that you can protect it, etc. Oh gosh, I wanted to get through more of this. Hold on. Let's see. Okay, this is an interesting point. This is an important point. We had said above. Mm, Okay, we said above that you cannot move a klishin rach al iser for protection, right, from the sun to the shade, whatever. So skip down to tesvav. Should be four lines up towards the beginning of the line. Tesvav in the Mishnah Berurah. See there, number 15, Hildy, if you want to look at it. So aser v'im choshev alav gam letashmish mutar letaltel afil ikar kavanas mecham letel. What does that mean? Oh, is that tazayin? Oh, my print is bad. Sorry. Tazayin aser. Yeah, it would be prohibited. Sorry. Tazayin aser 16. V'im choshev alav gam letashmish. And if you thought about deliberated already, I'm going to use this hammer. It's Friday afternoon. And you said, oh, I think we're going to have some walnuts tomorrow. Let's get the hammers out. Okay? You're using the hammers, meaning you've pre-designated the hammer for a good use. So then it becomes not mukta. It becomes prepared, and it's not something that you just left in the shed. Once it's in that category, so then you can move it for anything. You can move for anything. It basically takes on itself the category of klishe melachta leheter, because you've already predesignated it, right? So let's say Sarita, it's before Shabbos, and you say, "Oh my gosh, I'm going to have some leftover chicken soup, but I'm probably not going to need this huge pot, which doesn't fit in the fridge. I'd prefer to transfer it over into that other pot, which is the klishe melachta leheter, right? So if you needed the other pot." And you mamish couldn't fit the stuff in the fridge. Okay, so that's one story. Because then really maybe it's the tzorech. But if you're just doing it for convenience and you always transfer things out, so there's an interesting question there. Is that a tzorech? Is that necessary? But if before Shabbos you're looking at this pot and you're like, okay, we're not going to need this whole pot. I'm going to probably transfer it over to the other one. So maybe that's what the Nishabur is talking about. That's no longer a klishe melachta l'itzer. You can go take that for whatever purpose you want. Okay? That's what we're talking about. Right. If it's designated from beforehand. Okay, that's good enough for now. That's the Mishnah Berurah's psak about klishe melachta l'iser. There are other opinions. What?
Well, finish the sentence out.
I didn't finish the sentence?
Well, no, finish the, I mean, whatever the spot. It's
afilu ikaro kavanaso, ikar kavanaso mecham l'tzel, even the, if the main purpose is for the thing that you're not usually allowed to do, which is the protection of the hammer.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Right, once you've designated it for permitted use, you can use it for the other reason you're usually not allowed to use it for, right? To protect it. If the hammer is left outside, the pot is left outside, but you had pre-designated it from before Shabbos to be something you're going to use on Shabbos, so then you can move it even for reasons you're not usually allowed to move it for, because it's been pre-designated. That's what the Mishnah Berurah is saying. It is. That's how it's awesome. It's in the Mishnah Berurah. Now, it could be that that's your general understanding when you make soup, right? It's not like you have to verbally say, I hereby declare, right? You don't have to necessarily do that. But if it's something that you're typically doing, so then you're already, it's essentially like, if it's habitual that you always do that, so then it's probably already pre-designated. That's already good enough to be considered hoshev alav. The question is, when you never thought, you know, do we have anything to store this in? And then you're like, oh, we have those pots that we don't use except for cooking. So then it's like, oh, wait a second. Do you really need to use those pots or all those mukta? But if the pots that you're always using for storage, so odds are they're already pre-designated. And besides that, if you really needed to use those pots, you can't use the big pot. The fridge is packed. You can't use it anymore. So then you can use it anyways, even if it's a klishe melachta l'iser. There are, however, others who would say, this is just the Mishnah Berurah. Maybe next week we'll look at other opinions that would say that the definition of klishe melachta l'iser is even less than that, or it needs to be even more than that. Let's say that you have a hammer, but you often use it for other things that are mutter. I don't know, you're using it as a paperweight or something. So how much, what is the proportion of heter use that you need for to no longer be a klishe melachta l'iser, right? What transforms it into klishe? According to the Mishnah Berurah, it's got to be rov, 51%. There are other posts that say, no, even if there's a minimal amount of use that's allowed, so then it's not considered a klishe melachta l'iser. If I remember next Wednesday, maybe I'll bring up some sources for that and see if we pass one like that. Odds are, at the end, I'm just going to tell you to be machmer like the Mishnah Berurah, but it is always interesting to see if there are other opinions for the sake of argument to see how we define a klish malach lifter. All right, we're getting to the nitty gritty, the real practical details of what you can and can't move on Shabbos. Shkaya.